The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and online at thepulse.coopradio.org. I'm David Ball. On today's show, we're going to hear a panel discussion hosted by the U.S.-based Harm Reduction Coalition. They're looking to leaders across Canada in the drug user movement for answers on how to provide a safe supply of drugs and keep drug users alive, especially during COVID-19. The speakers on the panel include Garth Mullins with the BC Association of People on Opioid Maintenance, Dr. Mark Tyndall, an infectious diseases expert with the School of Population and Public Health at UBC, Dr. Nanki Ray of the Overdose Prevention Society of Toronto, and Kim Su, Medical Director with the Harm Reduction Coalition in New York.
Harm Reduction Coalition is really happy to have these wonderful people joining us to talk about this really important topic that I've been thinking about and a lot of you all have been working on the ground. I'm Kim Su. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm the Medical Director of Harm Reduction Coalition. I'm based in Brooklyn, New York. This has been a vexing topic for a long time. We continue to lose people to overdoses. And during COVID, everything that we were worried about before is happening even worse. Isolation, violence, lack of access to, steady supplies of substances that can prevent the most harms. Structural racism and structural violence, homelessness, housing instability, all of these things are worse. People are under increasing pressure. Safe supply, I think everyone's going to have their own definition, but really the idea, as I mentioned before, that people should be able to access substances that, that prevent, steady supply of access to substances that are not poisoned and not toxic, that are really what people need to stay out of the greatest harms. And a lot of times the harms come from when people are unable to access what they'd prefer to access, or it's unregulated, or it's cut with other things. We don't do, we really don't have comprehensive drug checking in this country. People really don't know. I talk to a lot of my patients and say, if you're taking methadone, you think you're on a dose, you're getting something that's regulated in theory. If you're taking something off the street, really it's a Russian roulette that is forced on you by our punitive drug policies. And so thinking about this across a range of substances, obviously opioids, but also thinking about stimulants, thinking about alcohol and other substances, I think it's important to conceptualize how that might work. In some of the COVID places where people who have been experiencing homelessness are living, different cities in the U.S. have been piloting safe supply of alcohol programs, which is really important. And we look to you guys in Canada for a lot of, some of the guidelines that you've been using have trickled into different cities in the U.S. So it's
my name is Nanki. I'm a family physician, and I work closely with people who use drugs in the downtown west side of the city of Toronto. And I've been based here in Toronto for the last 10 years, where I'm living on territories that I believe should remain under the full jurisdiction of the Wendat, the Anishinaabeg, the Haudenosaunee, and the Mississaugas of Credit First Nations. I'll leave it at that.
I'm Garth Mullins. I'm a drug user activist. I've been on opioids pretty much every day of my adult life. Yeah, I make a podcast called Crackdown. I'm part of a drug user union called the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. We're on Coast Salish territory, stolen lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. So thanks for having me.
Good morning, everybody, or afternoon. My name is Mark Tyndall, and I'm based in Vancouver. I was saying before this, I'm very pleased to be here because a week ago at this time, I was in hospital attached to chest tubes because I had a mountain bike accident. And what makes it even more relevant, I was using round-the-clock hydromorphone at that point. So I'm now officially somebody who can say hydromorphone saved my life. I've I'm not on it today, but it was pretty important to get me through a month in hospital. My work has been focused mainly in the downtown east side of Vancouver for the last 25 years. I was formerly the head of the BC Center for Disease Control, which is a large public health establishment, and I left there about a year and a half ago, mainly to pursue my work in the overdose crisis with a focus on safe supply. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But I'm a physician by training. I've had a lot of hands-on experience dealing with people who are using drugs. And my research career has really been in harm reduction.
Maybe we can just start off with everyone talking about how safe supply came to be, how you came to be involved or compelled in safe supply, and what it looks like in your area, and sort of logistically how it might work. Nanki, you want to start?
Sure, yeah. Before, I appreciate you starting us the way that you did, Kim, and I think it's important that while we're all kind of working towards creating these creative solutions to the overdose crisis, it's been really important for me as a clinician involved in this work to recognize that the safe supply programs aren't just to address overdose deaths. They're actually also trying to attempt to combat the over-policing and incarceration of people who use drugs, particularly people who are Black, Indigenous, people of color, people who are street-based, people who are queer and trans and two-spirit, basically all members of our community that are most pushed to the margins. And while safe supply programs are trying to do that, I think we also can't medicalize our way out of this crisis. And I think at the same time as we're fighting for safe supply programs, and I'm a huge advocate, we'll continue to fight for them, I think it's really, really important to recognize that we need to collectively organize and ensure that we're fighting for the defunding of police, we're fighting for the decarceration of our communities and our societies, and that we're also fighting for decriminalization as some of the urgent, necessary kind of policy and political shifts that need to happen to reduce the overdose crisis. Just to start off, I think while we talk about the nuts and bolts of these programs, I think that's always something that's heavy and present in my mind as we do this work. In terms of how I got involved, so I actually was training at the height of the overdose crisis. So I was finishing my family medicine training, graduated in 2017. I had a vision of what I would be doing as part of my work, was working predominantly with a lot of undocumented migrants, as well as with queer and trans communities, of course, including people who use drugs within those communities. And all of a sudden, a lot of my clients were experiencing high rates of overdose. A number of activists that I was familiar with and I knew for years in the city of Toronto decided to put up tents down the street from where I was training. And I think really showing up in Moss Park when the Overdose Prevention Society put up the first unsanctioned overdose site in our province really politicized me in a different way and shifted my clinical trajectory and the work that I'm doing both academically as well as clinically.
Garth, do you want to share a little bit about your relationship to safe supply?
Safe supply has been a part of my life and part of my political life and personal life since before we had that term. So the term safe supply actually comes from drug users. It is a demand from a social movement that's seeking human rights for drug users. And that's where that came from. It's been around for a long time before we actually had the phrase. I think the first time I was at a meeting about this was 1998. So 22 years ago. And we were talking about prescribed heroin back then. The original concept for a safe injection site was that we would prescribe heroin in such a facility. We weren't able to win that. It took civil disobedience and social movement organizing in order to get Insight in Vancouver and the other safe injection sites, which have since come throughout Canada. So a drug user movement is critical to all of this stuff. It kind of may sound like it happens in this world of people reviewing research and policies being made on evidence, but that's not what I've seen. I've seen that you have to arm twist the hell out of government to get anything. And that's still what we're doing. So the efficacy of safe supply has been studied in certain ways in Vancouver over years. We had trials here of prescribed heroin to see what the results were. Really positive. You can go look those up. but our government has not implemented them. Our governments have not felt moved. In Canada, we have these governments which are very friendly, warm and fuzzy talkers, but they actually still don't care about drug users. And so in my province, we've had record overdose deaths for the last 2 or 3 months. On top of a public health emergency of overdose fatalities, which has lasted for 5 years. And this is actually my second. There was an officially declared public health emergency in the 90s. So I've been an opioid user all the way through both of these crises. And in the 90s, my city also had the highest rates of HIV transmission in the industrialized world because governments and official policy were so stingy about syringe distribution. So it's like we're stuck in this difficult cycle of trying to convince the authorities to give us these simple things as our bodies stack up. I think that we're in a place where we need to take the control of opioids away from the medical world and into the control of drug users. And last year, myself and some researchers, doctors, and other drug users proposed something called the Heroin Compassion Club, or the Heroin Buyers Club model, where with the assistance of someone who can write prescriptions and exemption, a standing down of the law by government, we actually form a little group of people that buys diacetylmorphine from a pharmaceutical manufacturer, and we consume it and distribute it and get to live. That is still just an idea because the government hasn't been interested in implementing it, but we continue to fight for it. So the fact that the government has not been willing to do this and that we keep dying at this incredible rate meant that we've returned to kind of a direct action footing, civil disobedience, right? Like I was saying at the beginning of my comments, that's how we got safe injection sites. We actually opened illegal safe injection sites first, as people have done in the United States.
And that was Garth Mullins, producer of Crackdown Podcast and a member of the Vancouver-based BC Association of People in Opioid Maintenance. This is part of the Harm Reduction COVID-19 and People Who Use Drugs Harm Reduction Coalition event, in which Americans are hearing from some of the leaders in the Canadian movement for harm reduction and safe supply. This is The Pulse on CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. We'll go back now to Dr. Mark Tyndall.
I see my role in kind of academia and before that sort of in policy making to get out of the way. You know, I mean, I think we've just put so many rules around what we're doing, and physicians especially have been trained to like fix people, individual people. And this is so much more a big picture policy, structural violence. I mean, so even the most committed physicians are so restricted in working in this structurally violent situation that really hasn't changed. That's the most frustrating thing to me. We seem to make incremental changes in harm reduction. We spend so much time trying to open up a supervised injection site. I firmly believe in these things, but at this point in time when so many people are dying, I really see the limitations of doing that. You can spend all your activism capital on trying to get a site open or get a mobile van going. I mean, but it's such a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's so important. It's just the optics of that and moving the dial slightly forward. But if we're truly interested in saving literally hundreds of thousands of lives that have died in the last few years, I mean, we need to make much more dramatic changes in how that happens. And, you know, I was... I remember very vividly at the end of 2015 in when I was working at the BC CDC that we noticed this increase in number of people dying. We got the first toxicology showing that fentanyl was now ubiquitous among people dying. And 5 years later, we have done very little to directly address that problem. We've made progress in reversing overdoses. We've given out in the province of British Columbia, we've given out and trained so many people to give naloxone, and so many overdose have been reversed. For the 6,000 people who have died in my province in the last 5 years, for every death, there's 20 overdoses that don't result in death. So, I mean, it's just so massive, the problem out there. Insight and supervised injection sites were critical in engaging people who otherwise, you know, would not have any opportunity to get help if they wanted it. But as far as practically speaking, we should have been giving people safer drugs right from the beginning. And so this is not, should not be a new idea. And my last couple of years spending a lot of time in the supervised injection site where this MySafe project is located, it's just kind of ludicrous watching people come in knowing that they have drugs that could pull them down and then just be ready with oxygen and naloxone. I'm like, we've done that for years. And some days there's 10 or 15 people that need to be reversed. Like, why? Like, we wouldn't, it's really ridiculous when you think about it. We wouldn't allow that with any other poisoning. We wouldn't have a situation in a bar where people are, you know, drinking poison alcohol, and then we have a team of specialists there to reverse their their alcohol intoxication. I mean, it doesn't, you know, in some ways it's totally ludicrous what we're doing. A safe supply, and then so the progress we've made is really trying to get these injectable medicalized programs going. And I've been I was involved early with the Naomi project, 15 years ago with the heroin project in Vancouver. And I mean, for the people using it, it's been remarkable. So you can interview 140 a day who say that this has really been pivotal and saved their lives. They have a place to go. But it's a very, a select group of people who can go three times a day and be observed, and it becomes a community, it becomes kind of their lives. But if we're really serious about the thousands of people at risk today, it's not practical to think we can medicalize our way out of this and that people can be observed. That's just not the way people use drugs. And this whole idea also that we have to get everybody using in a room where we can watch them, that 80, 90% of people have been programmed to use drugs in secret. I mean, that's because we've criminalized their behavior, and it's just highly stigmatized. So to think all of a sudden we're going to flip a switch and then all these people who are using in their houses and rooms are going to just, oh yeah, let's just go and join it makes no sense. Some of the major obstacles, though, as has been pointed out, is physicians. So again, we're asking physicians to do exactly what we've told them not to do. Like, so we've demonized prescriptions so much that it's a 180 shift to say to a doctor, oh yeah, what you should be doing is prescribing Dilaudid or heroin or somebody to people. I mean, even the most progressive clinics in Vancouver in the downtown east side have a poster when you go into these clinics, we do not give out narcotics, like don't even ask. So we've programmed the whole system that these drugs are evil, that there's no, that people should get off them, that we have basically abstinence-based programs, which include methadone and Suboxone, saying the drugs you're using are bad, use my drug and come every day and we'll watch you use it, and then we'll make sure you're not using any other drugs or we'll penalize you for it. Like, you know, we've really excluded a lot of people from that system. So thinking somehow we're going to flip a switch and all these physicians who have been told not to be prescribing these or get your patients off these all of a sudden are going to be writing these big prescriptions for people, again, it's highly unlikely that's going to happen. So we need to make it a public, treat it like a true poisoning epidemic, that we need to have a public health response that allows people who qualify for a program to pick up a safe supply of drugs. To really make a difference, I don't think physicians can be the ultimate gatekeepers. I think it's important for people like me and Nanki and Andrea Suwada and people around who are prescribing these drugs in Canada to continue to kind of push the envelope as far as physicians, because I think we have a huge role in kind of socializing this idea. But as far as getting it to the next step, we really need to have the picture of, instead of buying from, you know, in an alley with a guy, you know, who has a black hoodie on, that you should be able to go somewhere and just purchase or get these drugs for free, that you know what they're doing.
On the physician end, the gatekeeping thing is actually really critical, and it's very frustrating in certain states within people's current practice, let's say regular primary care, to feel like you are the gatekeepers. And I think as an anthropologist, like, I step back and think about the social control, the power dynamic, the structural violence, like, embedded in our systems of institutions, that we're doing this dance, right? And really, it's about it, you know, it makes most other doctors incredibly uncomfortable. For example, doctors that are, like, you know, want people to be able to access cannabis, but don't want to have to do it, or it becomes this public health thing, this bureaucratic. I remember in Massachusetts, before it was, you know, legal, it was, you had to get $100, like, registration on a computer. None of my patients had a computer. None of my patients had $100, like, a photo ID. It was like, it became very, very difficult. You know, obviously it wasn't covered by insurance. It's much easier to go to to get it from an alley or wherever. So, I mean, I think the issue of gatekeeping, you know, taking it out of the hands of this relationship that at times is very violent and does harm to people who use drugs, is really critical. And, you know, like Nanki has said, and Mark as well, really trying to figure out how in the now, you know, in the context of our current reality that is so violent, how do we keep people alive to be able to do the work and get what they need outside of us, where we aren't, you know, where we don't have those jobs, and we can do primary care, but we don't force it on you. We can do your diabetes and stuff after you're well. And if those are things that you want to work on, we're there for you.
We ask everybody on the MySafe program, when I write a safe supply, what's their objectives of this? And everybody says to reduce or stop using drugs. So it's quite remarkable that we're fighting against people and we actually have the same long-term goal. So it's just unclear how and where when they're going to get there, but they need the agency to make those decisions. And so we're not, you know, directly fighting against people who want recovery, because I think that's what most people sort of want. But we've decided what recovery looks like, and that's getting my 12-step program, and these are my rules, and it doesn't work. Like, the remarkable thing about the pushback from recovery, they have no evidence. As Garth said, they even tell you that this is a relapse. We realize this is a relapsing problem. You're going to be in and out of recovery. I mean, this unicorn thing, even for the hardcore recovery people, know it's not going to happen when you just come into my program once. I mean, they realize that. So it's just totally impractical to make this an argument. The people, the first step right now is to keep people alive and give them the opportunity to make some decisions and have some agency and not be in a police state and in and out of jail and poverty and living on the street. I mean, it's just, that's fixable.
No wonder people don't trust us. You know, I, as a medical director of Harm Reduction Coalition, get calls from people who are using all over the country who are just won't come, like, would rather die. And we all know that people who unfortunately feel this way, who would rather die than come see us because of that structural violence that's baked into the healthcare system, and the risk that people have, for example, being parents and not wanting to, you know, would rather, you know, die of sepsis than give up their kid or be separated from their child. And so I think we're all working towards the world where we can abolish those systems, and we need to recognize that the way in which we are becoming, you know, we have been, the DEA and other things like that have really percolated into the doctor's offices.
My experience has been, the minute you have your own particular agenda for somebody else, or the minute that your interaction is going to induce shame in a client or a person that you're working with, they will know right away that you're not actually there to support them and in their goals. So we have those similar conversations, Mark, that you do when people enroll into our program. And we have about 50 folks that are in our program at this time. And when I actually, you know, often the first answer is I want to get off drugs. And I actually peer into that a little bit more, being like, don't feel like you have to say that in order to get access to this program. And really quickly you find out, actually, my goal is I don't want to use fentanyl. My goal is to reconnect with my daughter. My goal is to get housing. You know, so much of it is addressing the structural violence that actually impacts people's relationship with drugs, as opposed to drugs themselves. And I think if anyone on the webinar today is interested in actually doing safe supply as a clinician, I think that's one of the most important things to ensure that the work that you're doing is centering on people's self-determination. It's an necessary prerequisite to feeling wellness and feeling healthy.
And that was excerpts from a panel discussion organized by the New York-based Harm Reduction Coalition on Wednesday.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.